solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
And I'm fairly achievement-oriented. And so I was finishing business school when I was about 28 years old. So 30 was the natural first marker because I had worked a couple of jobs before business school. I was going to work one more. But I was very clear that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. So by setting a marker at 30, it forced me while I was at Harvard Business School to start actually working on my new venture, which was a private equity fund. And doing things, I found my partner there. I started, you know, preparing, building a network, you know, etc. And then, you know, because I had a marker at 45, you know, even though I was in a corporate job, I was running this private equity fund, I started cultivating these other interests. I started sitting on a couple of other nonprofit boards when I was in my mid-30s. And then by the time I was 40, I had already started thinking about it very seriously and made the decision. And then actually by 42, 43, I managed to exit the corporate world. So I think having this big role model, but also, you know, having a sense that it takes at least 10, 15 years to make a meaningful contribution. That's how I came up with these markers in a sense.
Welcome to the 65th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and I work with leaders as an executive coach, sounding board, or as a transition advisor as they navigate the journeys. The two questions I try and help leaders with are where to go and how to grow. I find that these two questions are quite parallel to the two questions businesses need to ask in the context of their strategy, where to play and how to win. In this podcast series, we feature conversations from leaders from different walks of life on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. My guest this time is Ashish Dhawan. Ashish is an alumnus of Yale University, has an MBA with distinction from Harvard Business School, and after a two-year stint at Goldman Sachs, he founded Chris Capital, one of India's leading private equity funds. He subsequently left that on high, short of his 45th birthday, and over the last 5+ years, he's immersed himself in reforming the space of education. He's the founder of Central Square Foundation, a philanthropic fund and policy think tank focused on transforming the quality of school education in India. He's also one of the driving forces behind Ashoka University, India's first liberal arts university, just to name a couple of things that he's been busy with in the last few years. In our conversation, Ashish speaks about how he had markers for himself at 30 and 45, which I found extremely interesting. At 30, he wanted to turn entrepreneur, which he did. And at 45, he wanted to move from the corporate world to the world of social impact. And he managed to do that a few years ahead of time. Without further ado, let's listen and learn from Ashish Dhawan. Ashish, thank you so much for making the time. Excited to have you on the Play to Potential podcast.
It's great to be here, Deepak.
Maybe just to kick things off, Ashish, as I was researching for this conversation, I picked up the fact that you enjoyed teaching math to kids as you were growing up. You know, you talk about teaching the seventh graders when you were in the 11th grade. You also mentioned saying this to your mom and she telling you all this is great, but now just focus on excelling and your journey. It's interesting that you've sort of come back to education after all the twists and turns. I'd love to maybe start with your early years, Ashish, as you look at your journey from where you stand right now. Talk to us a little bit about maybe some of those formative experiences which played a role in setting you up for life.
Yeah, so I went to school in Calcutta. My parents were living there at that point. I was in St. Xavier's. And I would say I was an average student, and then somewhere, I think, around the 8th or 9th grade, I understood that sort of academics were really important to get into a a good college and set you up for success in life, in at least the work life. So I then started to do well, you know, academically thereafter. Math was always my favorite subject. It's something I enjoyed. And I was a math science student in 11th and 12th grade. And I think like a lot of sort of typical students at that time, there weren't that many distractions other than playing sports and, you know, participating in school extracurricular activities. I mean, I was a reasonably good sort of all-rounder in that sense. You know, other than that, there were no distractions with TV or video games or social media. So I think spent a lot of time studying, particularly in the later grades, and did well, you know, academically. The math thing that you referred to in 11th grade was I switched schools and went to a school called St. James's. And there's a principal there, John Mason, who was quite charismatic. And, you know, he came up with this idea that, you know, get a few students from the senior most grades to go to middle school and just do a class and see what it's like. And can we be more innovative? Can we inspire the younger ones a little bit? Mm-hmm. I had a grandfather, my Nanaji, who was a sort of polymath is the way I would describe him. I mean, he was really well-read across many different disciplines, but he was a self-taught mathematician. He had taught me math at a young age, but more importantly, made it really fun and taught me a lot of mental math as well. And so I did that in this middle school classroom, and I think the students enjoy it. And I think when you're teaching, what gives you confidence is when you see the students are really having fun, when they're learning, when some magic is happening in the classroom. And I could see that. And so I think, you know, I felt like that was my calling. And I remember running back home and talking to my mom about it. My mom was very pragmatic, and she was the driving force. At that stage of my life, you know, the one who pushed me academically, she's the one who said, listen, you get into Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, you can go abroad. Otherwise, you keep studying and go to IIT here if you can get in. So, you know, she basically said, listen, that's fine. There's another day for that. But right now, focus on getting into the right college and making money and setting yourself up for life. So I think like I was a fairly typical kid in that sense. I mean, I didn't have a clear sense of direction, to be honest. I was very focused on the near term. I was studying for the IITs through correspondence courses and stuff like that. And at the same time, I gave the US a shot. I happened to apply early to Yale and I got in. And so that put me on a slightly different trajectory from most of my classmates, because at that time, most people weren't going to the U.S. for undergrad. But it wasn't clear to me when I entered Yale where I was going to end up. I guess I was inspired a little bit. My dad is a corporate guy, and I could see. So I had some insight into the upper echelons of the corporate world in India. And I could see myself getting into the corporate world, and somehow banking appealed to me, finance, because it's mathematically oriented, appealed to me. But other than that, I didn't know much, to be honest.
Got it. I think moving forward in one of the other conversations, one of the things you said really struck a chord with me. You talk about having markers in your head when you were at Harvard Business School. You said, you talk about the fact that you told yourself, I'll turn entrepreneur when I'm 30. I'll turn a philanthropist when I'm 45 and so on. Before we speak about these specific markers you set for yourself, talk to us a little bit about, you know, this concept. Maybe elaborate a little bit on how it worked in your head. And maybe also as you look forward, how do you think about these markers as you think about your journey, as you look ahead?
Yeah, so I think it came from my reading in a sense. And I've always believed in having role models, both big and small. Small one being you know, more friends who you interact with every day. They're like mini role models where there's one thing they do much better than you or much better than everybody else. You can learn from them. And then they're the sort of bigger role models who inspire you and provide you with some direction. And one of my role models always is Benjamin Franklin. I mean, when I read his autobiography, I was sort of naturally attracted to him because, you know, he was a largely self-taught person. He was in business, ran a printing shop for many years, but had multiple interests and really then cultivated those interests later in life. You know, had a second career outside of business, was a scientist, was obviously father of the Constitution, so had a political life to some extent and contributed to its nation building, but also, you know, had sort of other esoteric interests. He was one of the founders of the University of Pennsylvania. He was the founder of the American Philosophical Society. So I, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, my grandfather was somewhat of a polymath and had multiple interests. You know, he wrote Urdu poetry and loved math and still did math on the side, even as he ran a business. And on the side, he ran a chain of schools, which was his sort of philanthropic endeavor or his education, love for education. So I think this idea, I think from maybe these two individuals, one close to me in flesh and blood and one who I had read about and I was very inspired by, you know, this idea got set in my head that, you know, maybe I don't need to be fixated. I saw my dad. My dad was like a journey, you know, company man. You know? Mm-hmm. One of those Japanese company journeymen. You know, he worked, he was a chartered accountant, and then he worked for the same company for 25 plus years, and then worked with one other individual for the rest, the remaining years of his productive life. And I know a lot of people switch jobs today, but they really are sort of doing more of the same thing going forward, in a sense, running the rat race on the treadmill. And, you know, I thought that maybe being inspired by these individuals, Ben Franklin and my grandfather, that having multiple careers would be more exciting. It would push you to get outside your comfort zone, to challenge yourself again, put you on a new trajectory, rejuvenate you. And so I think these markers were helpful because I think you need a minimum of 10 to 15 years to achieve something in one career. And I'm fairly achievement-oriented. And so I was finishing business school when I was about 28 years old. So 30 was the natural first marker because I had worked a couple of jobs before business school. I was going to work one more. But I was very clear that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. So by setting a marker at 30, it forced me while I was at Harvard Business School to start actually working on my new venture, which was a private equity fund. And doing things, I found my partner there. I started, you know, preparing, building a network, you know, etc. And then, you know, because I had a marker at 45, you know, even though I was in a corporate job, I was running this private equity fund, I started cultivating these other interests. I started sitting on a couple of other nonprofit boards when I was in my mid-30s. And then by the time I was 40, I had already started thinking about it very seriously and made the decision. And then actually by 42, 43, I managed to exit the corporate world. So I think having this big role model, but also, you know, having a sense that it takes at least 10, 15 years to make a meaningful contribution. That's how I came up with these markers in a sense.
Got it. And maybe just going back to the point you made about the self-assessment or self-awareness that you're entrepreneurial. And I can imagine coming out of Harvard, you know, the opportunity cost is quite high, right? In terms of the kind of placements and the companies that come on campus. So could you expand on that? Where did that hunch come from, that you're sort of entrepreneurial in orientation?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a lot of what maybe people said to me and maybe partly the confidence I got when I was at Harvard Business School. So as I mentioned, my dad was a company man. And so looking at him, the natural thing to do would have been go join a big company and stick with it for a while, or at least stay in that universe for a long period of time. It would have been a good, it's actually low risk in a sense.
Right.
My grandfather, on the other hand, was a hell of a risk taker. And that generation, anyway, had to deal with losing everything in what is now Pakistan and moving to India. And so, you know, there was a whole different element of risk in that and dealing with adversity and stuff, which I heard about when I was younger. And then, you know, my second job after undergrad, but before business school, was at a private equity fund, actually, called MDC. And the founder, George McCowan, had been to Stanford undergrad and Harvard Business School, 35 years older than me. Mm-hmm. But he took a real liking to me. I mean, I was a young guy at the firm. And it turned out that he was an Indophile. And it's interesting, you know, we made a three-week trip to Asia. We were raising a new fund and we said, let's try to get some Asian investors. This was very early days. You know, I joined them in late 93. And so this was in late 94 that we made this trip. And we spent a week in India and introduced him to a few people through my dad. And, you know, George ended up giving an interview to a couple of magazines, Business India and one of the newspapers. And in that, he sort of casually mentioned, he never told me about it, that, hey, you know, we have this young bright star, Ashish, who works with me. And by the way, he's thinking about going to business school, but I can assure you that he's going to come back here someday and do what I've done in the US, which is set up a private equity fund. And if he ever chooses to do it, I'm there to support him.
Fascinating.
And I, you know, I read the, I actually was not there in the room with him when he gave I read the interview afterwards when I had flown back to the US. And, you know, it's one of those things where when your boss sort of has this confidence. So I went to him when I saw the other, I said, really, George?
And he was like, what not? It's you a know, fascinating I, way of giving feedback.
Yeah, I know. I think having a mentor who just believed that I could do it. I mean, he himself had turned entrepreneurial much later in life. But, you know, he was sort of putting his arm around me saying, listen, I'm there for you. Just think about doing it much earlier. And having my grandfather's own example who, you know, kept saying, listen, you have all the degrees. So what's the downside, you know? And so I think it's a lot of framing in your mind. I started to convince myself that, you know, frankly, people talk about downside, but what's the downside? You know, I was going to move back to India. I was going to stay in my parents' home. So I had like a zero cost base. So I didn't have to be earning a lot of money. I had the support system. I had degrees from good places, so, and a network of friends. So even if things failed, in 3 to 5 years, I could land somewhere. I was pretty confident of that. So, you know, what really was the downside in doing something entrepreneurial is the way I looked at it. And so doing it very early at age 30 makes sense to me because, you know, when you're younger, you're more dynamic, you can work harder, you know, stuff like that. So it didn't seem odd to me to be doing it at age 30 versus getting a high-powered, you know, well-paying job. And in fact, I did work for 2 years and actually got paid very well because I worked for Goldman and I worked in their hedge fund group, which is a small group. And so, you know, the comp and bonus actually was very good. But because I'd made up my mind, it was a 2-year thing. I was not getting hooked onto the corporate bandwagon. And my other belief is if your needs are small, I mean, I think a lot of people, as their comp goes up, their needs go up. They want a bigger apartment. They want a fancier car. They want their kids to go to the fanciest school, private school in the US or whatever. You know, you then have a cost base that keeps you on the treadmill. If your cost base is fairly low, you then have a lot of flexibility because you really don't need the comp in the early years.
And I'm also curious about what it takes to succeed, right? Let's say in a platform like a Goldman Sachs versus, you know, a 0 to 1 when you're starting something on your own. Could you talk a little bit about how you grew as a person in turning entrepreneur? If you reflect on taking the plunge in, let's say, the early years, in what ways were you stretched at that point in time?
Yeah, so look, I was really young. I mean, I started creating the plan when I was sort of 29 out of my small little 600 square foot apartment where I lived in Manhattan with my wife. I was married by then. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, the other thing on downside, I somehow, ironically, I had this view that once you're married, you're sort of at least secure on the home front. Mm. So you don't have to, it's actually a better time to be entrepreneurial. So anyway, she was a good support because she always encouraged me to do what I wanted to do. And so I did a little bit of the prep work, got the PPTs in order. And then when I quit, I was fortunate that my former boss, George, gave me office space in New York. And I was in New York about 6 months. I think the key to starting a private equity fund is fundraising. You know, if you can have the best ideas and all, but if you can't raise the money, you can't get going. It's interesting, I had zero work experience in India, other than a couple of summer internships when I was a college kid, you know, working in a Citibank branch, helping the branch manager, and, you know, literally things like that. Those were my summer internships. That's my only work experience in India. I was raising an India-focused private equity fund. I was also doing this in the midst of, you know, a period when the Asian crisis had just happened. So people were, you know, the early guys who invested in Asia were just like, had given up. And then to top it all off, you had the 98 nuclear tests done by India and then the response by Pakistan and New York Times running these articles saying that, you know, this is the most dangerous place on earth. So it was a difficult time. I think what entrepreneurship taught me is first and foremost that sales is very important. I mean, you know, as an entrepreneur, you're always selling. You're trying to recruit somebody. I managed to recruit someone who I met through the Goldman Network, who was at Goldman at the time, who had been with my brother at Cornell, a guy called Kunal Shroff, who was a superstar. Mm. And partly because, you know, I was able to sell him on the idea that, listen, we're going back, but we're going to do something amazing and, you know, et cetera. Similarly with investors, you know, as a salesman, you not only learn how to read people and how to make to customize a pitch in real time and to endear yourself to people, but you also sort of have to have real tenacity and perseverance. I mean, we had a 98% rejection rate. To wake up every morning and be back on the road to have, you know, database and do this research all by yourself to figure out who, to work the network, to build that database, and really to be shameless in a sense.
And at that stage, Ashish, if I may ask, given you had limited experience in the Indian market, what were you selling, right, in terms of returns? Yeah. What was the basis on which people could build confidence with you?
Yeah, so one is I had, you know, some private equity experience, investing experience in the U.S. I'd done private equity pre-HPS, and I'd worked at Goldman in sort of the hedge fund business and covered Latin America and the U.S. So I had some investing, but limited number of years. I was basically selling the macro India story and the fact that there's a couple of, you know, smart guys who you can trust who will, you know, be entrepreneurial and sort of figure it out as you go along. So that in a nutshell was it, which is a hard sell, to be honest. But today it wouldn't work because the landscape has changed. There's so many PE players out there. But in that era when, you know, the industry was being formed, I think it was more about selling yourself, your capabilities, your ability to pull it off, and the overall macro story in a compelling way. And that's why the hit rate was so low, because most people were skeptical, you know. I mean, the macro seemed to be quite bad, actually, at that point in time. And what are these two young guys who never really worked in India? How are they going to figure it out? They're going to get eaten alive. You know? But I think being able to leverage, in a sense, you know, the people who were willing to bat for me. So when I left Goldman, the CEO of Goldman put in personal money, the guy who ran my group, who was a pretty high-powered guy, youngest partner ever at Goldman, put in money. I had 7 or 8 partners at Goldman, and a few other people who were quite well-known. Actually, at that time, Rajat Gupta, who was at McKinsey, you know, put money in. So people who were very credible and who were willing to bat for me, I think that's what eventually got us the money raise. So being able to target those people first and get them on board and get them to speak on our behalf was really the way we convinced people.
Mm-hmm. And moving forward on the journey of building a PE fund, Ashish, what's having done this for a while, what's your take on some of the intrinsics required to be an effective PE investor? And the reason I ask is, you know, as we think about career choices, you know, one is sort of the skill level hygiene, right? What's your educational background required? But every profession has a certain DNA to be successful. If you had to decode the DNA of a successful PE investor, not that there is one archetype, but what are the two, three must-haves at a deeper level for somebody to flourish in this space?
Yeah, so I think there are a few. And I would say, by the way, I think liberal arts education is good training for the PE business, because I don't think you can be unidimensional. A lot of people think to be a PE investor, you've got to be good at, say, economics and analysis, you know, just data crunching, reading balance sheets, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's much more than that. I think that at different levels, you need to be fairly skilled. The first is, I think, at an emotional level and psychological level. I think a deep ability to somewhere be a critical thinker, to have confidence in your own thinking, but yet keeping an ear to the ground and being able to listen, but being able to filter out what you're hearing. And to be able to control your emotions, I think, is absolutely critical. You know, that when you are an investor, you're surrounded by a lot of market noise. And I think the easiest thing to do is to be wallowing in other people's thoughts or in the, you know, dancing to the rhythm of the market. And in fact, the best investors are contrarians. To be a contrarian, you have to have that in your DNA to be able to think independently, to almost stand up to the crowd. But in this case, you can't do it. You can't remove yourself from the crowd, because then you stop listening, because you can get things wrong and sometimes do need to pivot. So I think that's one essential trait, is know thyself and think deeply about yourself. Be a little bit of a psychologist almost. At one level. I think at a second level, you have to be a, you know, big picture person, almost a macroeconomist and a historian. Macro, because you got to understand, you know, how the economy works, different sectors, what the drivers are, and at a very fundamental level, have a sense of that. But a historian, because you have to understand, you know, how industries have developed over time, how market cycles have played out. Having that perspective of how it's happened before, how bubbles got created, you know, what were the best times to invest. So I think having historical perspective, I believe, is absolutely critical. And being a little bit of a big picture thinker is important. You can't just say, oh, I'm looking at this company and doing due diligence. You get too narrow and you lose the forest for the trees, in a sense. So I think having that trait is important. And I think a third is just to be a sort of being shrewd or street smart, I think is critical. Particularly when you're in India, I mean, I think there's a lot of governance issues with companies. There are always people running after you to get your money, but then they're not going to deliver returns. So I think being able to just be really street smart and shrewd and not let people take you for a ride, which means, I think, just being skeptical, having sort of informal networks to suss people out, looking for signals, body language. I mean, I've always believed being able to read body language is very, very critical. You know, being able to ask questions in a certain way and see how people fidget or react gives you a sense of whether they're honest or dishonest, or almost developing your own polygraph, in a sense, is critical to being able to figure people out. So I think that third dimension is also very, very critical. You know, being street smart, being grounded, being able to read people, being able to suss out the bad apples, in a sense, which no textbook, no analyst who writes research reports is going to be able to tell you. I think those are very important traits. And then the fourth one, I think, is just staying the course. I think, you know, it's very easy as an investor to want to either drink the Kool-Aid, and it happened with the emerging markets, and just believe in your investments and stay with them forever, right? And, you know, at every level, you kind of think your company's gotten better. And then at the same time, there's the danger of being too myopic. At the first sign of trouble, you want to just bolt. I think finding that halfway house where, you know, you stay the course, but at the same time, because there are market cycles, you play the market cycles well, that you zig when other people are zagging. You know, when people are, you know, fundamentally at the top of the market, getting excited, you're actually exiting companies, and at the bottom of the market, you're actually investing quite a bit of money. So I think having that makeup, I think, is very, very critical.
Got it. Just going back to one of the things you mentioned, Ashish, filtering out the signal from the noise. If you had to maybe just expand on that, you know, you need to have your own conviction, but at the same time, you need to listen enough to what's happening in the market. Any, if you had to sort of peel that, any thoughts there on how one could walk the tightrope?
Yeah, so I think firstly, not all noise should even be paid attention to. I mean, like, as an investor, I just wouldn't watch CNBC. It was a waste of time. And that's noise that is just absolutely distracting. The noise I'm referring to is the view of even smart participants in the market. So research analysts write on companies. I'd want to read their reports. Even there, over time, you figure out who the better ones and you prioritize your time reading the better ones. To understand market cycles, there are great investors out there and great thinkers, you know, Buffett himself, Howard Marks, people like that. And so you read them to stay attuned to market cycles. So I think to be a good investor, you have to read a lot. I mean, Buffett is 89 and still reads more than 500 pages a day.
Wow.
And so I think you just have to be that curious individual who reads a lot. But I think figuring out what you're reading, being able to filter out the crap very quickly, so you're reading better stuff. And even when you read the contrarian views, you've got to cull out the fact from opinion and then be able to create the opinions for yourself. But when I say keep your ear to the ground, because other people will have access to facts that you don't. They've garnered something. They've done some research on comparables from elsewhere. They've found out something about the company and connections with other companies. They've analyzed the balance sheet the way you haven't. So you can't ignore that. So I think being able to cull out facts from different places, but having that, I almost feel being away from the noise center makes you better. And so one of the reasons I moved to Delhi was partly personal. My parents, my wife's parents, but partly I had this belief that Bombay is the noise center with regards to the markets. And being away from Bombay would make me a better investor. And I think that's true if you look at even people like Pulak Prasad, who was at McKinsey, who I think is a good investor. He lives in Singapore. He's away from the noise. He's not talking to the Bombay people every day. Buffett lives in Omaha and not in New York. I think just being away from the noise helps you as well, because your friends then are not people from that world. They're from another world. So it's you're not consumed by the noise, in a sense.
That's a great insight. I was talking to Dr. Ramachandra Guha in a different context on the podcast as well. And he made a very similar point, saying, you know, since I don't sit in Delhi, it's much easier for me to be independent with my views as compared to when I'm in Delhi. So a similar point he made in a different context. Got it. Moving forward, Ashish, you'd spend some time in CRISPR Capital. Clearly, financially, it was lucrative. As you thought about the next innings, you know, one of the questions I think about and ask some of the people in the podcast is, you know, when you reach a certain level of financial outcomes, you always have the choice of changing course and giving back in some way to the society. Or you could say, you know, I'm on a track where I've figured out, you know, how to create financial returns. Why not create more wealth, stay the course, and maybe write a bigger check to make a bigger dent? How did you process choices when you neared 45?
Yeah, so I mean, I think a few things. One is, even in terms of my business, I had what I call controlled ambition. We did raise like the first $1 billion domestic private equity fund back in 2007. So I was ambitious, but I actually cut it back in size when the crisis happened, down to 950 million, because I wanted our investors to know that I cared more about returns than about size. I never really believed that size was the most important thing, that actually having a good reputation as a good investor who did well for, you know, your LPs, your clients, was really the best thing. And so that controlled ambition, you know, we had the opportunity to look at Southeast Asia. In fact, spent a year and a half visiting companies and potentially looking at expanding our business there. We thought about expanding our business into real estate or some other asset investing class, but we just stayed away from it. It was controlled ambition. Just do what you do well, build a good reputation, just deliver consistent returns. I think that was important to me. In terms of the financial side, I think because I had this controlled ambition, you know, I was not wild with my ambition that somehow I want to take $1 billion fund to a $5-10 billion fund. Firstly, I'm a realist. India has only so much absorptive capacity, particularly if you want to keep generating consistently good returns. And so I didn't want to overextend. I think sometimes when you're in that, you know, you convince yourself that you're going to do the next big thing and the next big thing. Mm-hmm. I sort of felt that I'd gotten the platform to a certain stage where now it was secure. We had raised 5 funds. I stayed till we raised the 6th, but with the explicit understanding that I would not be around anymore. That I knew I had set us on a trajectory where, you know, we could get to fund 10, and if my colleagues did well, that, you know, they could build the business beyond. So building something to last was important to me. And I wanted to get out at that point in time when I knew that I had put the firm in good hands, in a sense. Mm-hmm. As far as my own personal situation, you know, I never let my expenses, it's not that I live a ascetic or super frugal life, but I never let my expenses grow in line with my income. I mean, they grew at a much slower trajectory. I had no real desire for fancy cars or for anything super fancy. And so, you know, in that sense, I think having a little bit of that detached attachment towards material goods makes it easier to walk away from the desire to accumulate more, whether it's paper wealth or electronic wealth or physical things, you know, etc. And so, I looked at it, I said, look, I've been very lucky. God's been kind. I've been done financially very well in my 30s. And, you know, I have the ability to step off. And importantly for me, that marker, I think, was critical. You know, I think once you put it in your head that you want to have a different career and you have a marker, you then start working towards it. And so I never had this desire then to continue on and, you know, do something bigger, better, etc. Because that marker was there. And I said, enough is enough. Frankly, if I had made a fifth of what I'd made even mm-hmm. in terms of financial wealth, or even a tenth, I probably would have made the same decision.
And on that note, just like you had a marker in terms of time, did you have a marker in terms of the number you had in mind in terms of if I hit this number in terms of savings or, you know, wealth, that's a trigger, or you just had a rough order of magnitude?
Yeah, no, I did. Because I just said, look, I if I have to be able to live with zero income,
sure,
what does it take, right? And, you know, if I conservatively invest that money, and even with a 6-7% return, you know, what is the minimum that I need? Where I obviously in that scenario, I wouldn't have been able to put my own money into philanthropic ventures. I would have had to go raise it. I would have given my time pro bono. But then it would have been a much larger, it would have been like an NPV of my salary in a sense, is what I would have looked at in terms of, and plus a little bit just to secure the kids and everything else, but not much more than that.
Got it. And maybe moving to that junction you were in, Ashish, where you decided to move on from Chris Capital, you know, one of the questions that I encounter in the context of the work I do with some of the leaders is, you know, I've sort of made the money I want for the rest of my life. There's enough buffer in it to take care of a few adverse scenarios. How should I spend my time? I mean, I still have the next 20, 30, 40 years of active life left ahead of me. Talk to us about how you process that fork in the road. I'm sure you had multiple choices, right? Back to your point you made, you could have turned professor and, you know, taught, given your passion for education. You could have invested in education companies, or you ended up setting up Ashoka. So talk to us a little bit about the architecture of choices in your head and how that played out early in that transition.
Yeah, so, I mean, I did, it's funny you bring it up. I did toy around with the idea of becoming a professor because academic life appeals to me. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I reached out to, and one of my mentors was a former dean of Harvard Business School, and he'd also been an investor in our fund. And Jay Light, who was the person, said, listen, I know you'll get frustrated in this in a couple of years, so don't become a professor, don't become a high school teacher. Because my pitch to him was, even if I become a high school teacher, I'll write books and I'll do videos and, you know, I'll do like Sal Khan. I'm not going to be like a regular teacher. But so anyway, I mean, I think at the core, when I think about it, I'm an entrepreneur at heart. So I like creating new things. So that's one. And two is the sort of education bug was within me from early on. And I've already also believed just at an intellectual level that, you know, it's the bedrock of society. And if you want to transform not only the economy, but also society, you know, you got to work on education. And so it just felt like the right higher calling, you know, for me. And then in terms of choices, I think the Ashoka thing, in a way, I'd always, you know, I had an amazing experience at Yale. I got exposed to the US, to liberal arts education. It transformed me personally. It created multiple interests for me. You know, I learned Spanish and then eventually Portuguese, fell in love with Latin America. I became good at learning languages. I sort of learned a lot of different things. You know, I developed a love for history. I had many interests. And so I really wanted, when I came back to India and I was recruiting people, I found them to be much more unidimensional and not having too many interests beyond the sort of narrow work interest. And so this idea of building a liberal arts university was always somewhere in the back of my head. And then it sort of just happened. You know, while I was at Chris Capital, Sanjeev Bikchandani and a few friends were talking about this idea of building a new St. Stephen's. There was another group of IITians who were very interested in building an engineering college. And eventually when we came together, and quite frankly, Pramath Sinha, who's an ex-colleague of yours from McKinsey,
right,
was someone that I reached out to because I had met Pramath earlier, and Sanjeev knew him as well. We all came together as a group. And frankly, Sanjeev and I pushed very hard to say, because we were putting in the initial capital, that we want this to be a liberal arts university because that's what you really care about. And so that's how Ashoka emerged. And in 2010, we bought the land. This was that was the same year I announced that I was leaving Chris Capital. I told my LPs. And I still had a year and a half before I transitioned out. So the Ashoka project was underway. And then with Central Square Foundation, which is focused on school education, I had been on the boards of one or two nonprofits even prior to while I was in my work life. I also started to give small bits of money to some nonprofits so I could go out in the field, you know, on a Saturday to just see what happens. I started reading books on education reform. And so it was clear to me that I wanted to build a foundation that worked more on system reform in school education. And then I actually took a month off and visited about 60, 70 different foundations and nonprofits in the US to just learn about teacher training, curriculum development, ed tech, you know, a variety of different areas. And so then it became clear to me that, you know, at Central Square Foundation, we were going to work on this idea of system transformation and really work by leveraging grant making. But a lot of foundations just focus on grant making, that we would actually work on sort of doing research and building ecosystem, but also on policy making and then eventually working with government on system reform. So, and what attracted me most was the system reform part. So these are the two early projects. I think I was naturally attracted to them because my own personal interest in school education, becoming a teacher early on in life, and then my Yale experience and therefore the desire to build a liberal arts university.
Got it. And maybe back to the point you made about the person in Harvard dissuading you from a career in academics. Any other pathways you said no to? I'm curious about, while you picked these two, I'm curious about what you said, what else you said no to at this junction.
Yeah, so I was very clear I didn't want to do anything commercial. So the idea of investing in, you know, another format, personally running a family office or whatever, that didn't appeal to me, you know, because I had already done that at a bigger scale earlier. I didn't, you know, there was, of course, offers to be on boards and all. That's not me. I'd been on one or two boards. It's too passive a role for me. And maybe I was also too young for it. But I just think it's, in India anyway, it's you don't have that much influence. Or at least you try to convince yourself you have a lot of influence. And frankly, I'm too entrepreneurial where I just get tired of sitting in these meetings, you know, I get frustrated and can't deal with it. So that choice I ruled out of just being like doing like 8 or 10 boards and trying to contribute in that fashion. I could have, you know, taken a job running a foundation, but it would have sort of boxed me into somebody else's worldview and taken away a little bit of that entrepreneurial spirit. It would have given me more money up front, you know, if I looked at a Gates Foundation or a large fund or convinced a large foundation in the US come to India and, you know, I'll put your money to work intelligently. But it would have been, you know, reporting into someone in the US who didn't understand the context. And I was just worried about the entrepreneurial. It would have, whilst it would have given me much more by way of resources up front, it would have constrained me. So those are some of the choices, I think. I wasn't going to go run an NGO because I just felt I didn't have enough ground experience. And, you know, at the core, I want to play to my strengths, which is, you know, I still believe that I'm more of a strategic thinker. I know how to recruit people. I know how to pull things together. I know how to mobilize the capital. But I'm not necessarily the best person to go and actually do the work, you know, on the ground. So that's why I sort of ruled that out in terms of starting some kind of large-scale NGO.
Got it.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. The point Ashish makes about his distinctive strengths is interesting. I feel, at this stage, this self-awareness is paramount for us to make choices and to cut losses in case we go down a path that turns out to be less fulfilling. Nanda Nilekani spoke about this in the context of him course-correcting after trying his hand at politics.
Bro, it was an intellectual choice, actually, to get into politics. But my experience was not very happy. And in that sense, I think that was one transition where I stepped too far in some sense. It was way outside my comfort zone. So I, after the election campaign and after that, I realized that this was not where I want to be. That I didn't have the leverage. I didn't have competitive advantage in that area. I didn't think I would be very effective. So I realized that actually my effectiveness comes from being what I'm good at, which is a technology-led transformation agent, and use my talents and abilities to solve large, intractable problems and make that available to anybody who wants to use it. So that was my shift.
If this topic is of interest, you might like my conversation with Tasha Urich, where she speaks about the notion of internal and external self-awareness, which becomes all the more important in these phases of high-stakes transition, where we decide on the trajectory of our life. You might also like the playlist Reinventing Yourself in the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com. If you're deriving value from the podcast, please consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation, a nonprofit that I work with closely. You can know more at the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com. Could I also request you to take a moment and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or any other platform where you consume this content? Given there's been an explosion of content supply in the podcast space recently, it will help people find this content and derive value from it, and also help us attract guests. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Ashish Dhawan.
And you've been on this journey for a decade plus now, Ashish. And if you had to sort of maybe juxtapose your growth in this phase versus your professional growth in Chris Capital and setting up and scaling up Chris Capital, maybe with a specific reference to leaders who are at that transition where they're moving from a successful corporate career to the social impact world, any pieces that took you by surprise in this journey in the last 10 years? What are some of the things that you probably didn't anticipate? And what would your perspective be for leaders who are at the transition point?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question, Deepak. And some of this, obviously, I learned with hindsight. I had my own naive assumptions when I went in. One is that, you know, as corporate people, particularly, I had about 20 years of investing under my belt. I've looked at lots of companies, a lot of industries. There's a little bit of this naive assumption that I can figure out this one pretty quickly. I'll read some stuff, I'll talk to some people, and I'll be able to synthesize it and come up with something different and put it out there that this is what needs to get done. And almost be able to start preaching to folks quickly. And, you know, I think in the social sector, the production function is very complex. I mean, the number of stakeholders you have, including the involvement of the government, the layers through which the whole education process gets transacted. You need an understanding of many things before you actually can make these comments. You need to read the evidence, the literature, which is more in the academic world. You need to understand sort of the content, which is curriculum, and look at curricular experts and instructional design. You need to understand pedagogy and how that works. You need to understand the system. How does government work? You need to understand money and what role the budgets play and things like that. And then, you know, over time, and understand the data, what data is out there, what's valid, what's not, and understand, you know, how does this system change actually work? Because it's a very complex function. To improve India's education system in one state, say Maharashtra, I think is much more complicated than running TCS, for instance. By the way, it's almost similar number of employees, in about 500,000 in each of those. But I think it's far more complicated to figure out how. And it would be naive. I mean, it's naive to come in with 2 months of understanding and try to go to the CEO of TCS and say, here's how you should run your company. It would be doubly naive to do that, you know, with the actors in education.
And what drives that delta complexity?
I think it's the fact that there are so many. One is it's a very complex production function. You know, how you educate a child is very complicated. I mean, there are home effects, and so you have to look at how you can improve home effects and what role the parent is going to play. We don't think about it in our homes because we sort of naturally, most of us play that role. But with a low income, less literate parent who has many other demands of their time and is dealing with the vagaries and vicissitudes of life, you know, what role should they play? What is positive parenting? How should they get involved with the education? You know, it is very, very complicated in figuring that out. How do you motivate a frontline government employee, change their belief system? How do you motivate them? There are 500,000 of them in Maharashtra, right? Teachers. And what tools do you give them to succeed? You have data in the system, and there's a natural tendency to inflate the data. It's a public system. How do you truth score admin data and improve it? You know, so that systemically you have better data coming out and make the assessments more low stake. How do you get people to start using data in this very complex system? You know, how do you get the middle management sort of retooled so it can play an important role in actually coaching, providing feedback, collecting more authentic data from what it's doing today? So that whole change management, you know, how do you do it within a public system? How do you get the political commitment? Because till you don't have the chief minister of a state behind it, you know, bureaucrats will keep changing. And, you know, you'll work for 2 years and then your work will be done. And how do you get not only the political commitment from the top, but deeper commitment? How do you get the top 400-500 people to sort of buy in and want the reform? So system change, I think, in the public system is much harder because you don't have the levers of control that you have, and neither do you have the capacity. You don't have a large HR department in the Maharashtra school system, right, to tell you how you're going to do, motivate employees and what tools you're going to provide them. You're sort of flying with a different sort of system of middle management, etc. So I think changing government and improving systems is hard because there is much greater inertia. The incentives are very, very different. And I think figuring that out is a big challenge if you've come from the corporate world where you're used to having the levers of control. The joystick is in your hand. And, you know, you come in naturally with all guns blazing with ideas. You also have a tendency to want to move quickly and, you know, have this. I mean, I remember coming in. And so I think one big mistake people who transition is, my advice would be sort of read a lot, listen, sparingly give advice in the first year, okay? Be more in learning mode and look to unlearn certain things and learn lots of new things because it's so complex. You need to really spend a lot of time deeply understanding it before you jump to conclusions. A second one, I think, would be you need a different sort of degree of humility, I think, working in the social sector. I think one is, you know, when you're selling a product to an individual, of course, you need to understand the customer. But here with the sort of beneficiary, I think you really need to go a little bit deeper to understand the beneficiary, what goes on in their home. And you're not just selling them a product. You're trying to change their life or their child's life. So I think having that empathy, but also being able to deal with a variety of different people. Most people in the NGO sector are not corporate types. They're not driven by money. They're here on a mission. They think a little bit differently. And I think attuning yourself to being able to work with them, I think it's critical. I think if one wears too much of that corporate badge or too much corporate lingo, you know, up front, you piss off a lot of people. I think so learning how to deal with the sector, I think is very, and respecting some of the people. I mean, these are people who've given up. They also went to IIM. They've given up, you know, 20 years of making money to do what they do. They're smart. They've learned a lot. I mean, they may think differently. They may behave differently. They may not have certain parts of the management toolkit you do. But for a moment, you know, learn how to build an empathetic relationship with them and see the positives that they have versus starting to question what they don't have in their toolkit. I think the third is, I think, learning to work with government. You know, I think when you're in the corporate world, you are just lobbying for your taxes to be lower or, you know, duties to be higher in your industry or just whatever you want to get done. It's that transactional relationship, and government anyway keeps you at bay as best as possible. I think when you're working in the development sector and you really want to work on system change, you have to work much more deeply with government. So understanding how do you build trust with government that you're not a transactional player, you're not just there to give them advice. But firstly, when you give advice, there's no bias, that you're truly looking out for the interests of the children and the system. And two, is you're willing to stay the course with them. You're not just a transactional player. You're actually going to help them, work with them, and eventually let them make the decisions, because we're there just to support. So we're not looking to take the credit away. We're not looking for glory. And I think that part of dealing with government in that manner is something at least I had not been exposed to, you know, in the corporate world at all. So I think there are a bunch of things you need to do differently if you want to be successful here.
Got it. And maybe coming to you specifically, Ashish, you spoke about learning and unlearning. And if you had to really highlight the couple of things that you had to unlearn, you spoke about control and having the joystick. I think that point is well taken. Any other headline themes around what you had to unlearn, and also the one or two muscles that got built in the last 10 years that you didn't have earlier?
Yeah, I think the things I had to unlearn were, you know, one is that this lingo part, right, that I had to hold back on, that there is maybe a development management is slightly different from corporate management. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep that in the back of your mind. And so, yes, sort of 60-70% transfers, but I think being acutely aware of what doesn't transfer, I think, is very important. I think how you recruit people is very, very different, because motivations are very, very different in this sector. And then how you manage them and get the best out of them, I think, is different, because the incentives that they respond to are very different. It's not money, it's something else. And of course, because there isn't money, I think people are very passionate, also therefore more opinionated, and much more, sometimes more rigid. So how do you deal with that? You know, learn how to, I think the people management side is very complicated in the nonprofit sector, because everything from recruitment to talent management to performance management, it needs to be done somewhat differently and carefully and delicately. Same is true in a university, by the way. And then I think the measurement is very, very hard. I think, you know, we're just used to, I think the corporate world makes it very simple with P&L and balance sheet and, you know, profitability and growth and ROE and ROC and all of that. I think there's no one single metric that cuts across the development sector. Each one will have its own set of metrics. There is a certain theory of change, but, you know, looking at what the most important outcomes are, how you'll measure it. Measuring is also not so easy. It's not like the data is just given to you on a platter. And then what are the sort of building blocks, the intermediate outcomes, and then the early lead indicators, and having that framework sort of clear, and being able, how do you get the data in a way such that it's reliable? So this whole measurement and evaluation, both in real time for feedback, but eventually evaluation to know whether something's working or not, is very, very different from the corporate world. And I think one needs to sort of look at that. I think the other thing that's different is, you know, I mean, marketing in the corporate world is to sell your product. I mean, here you're trying to, you know, you're providing a service to beneficiaries. So it's very, very different in terms of, I think, where you're doing your marketing is more around fundraising. And fundraising is, again, different, because you're trying to push buttons where you get people to emotively connect with an issue, which is, again, different from the way you do it, I think, in the corporate world. And to convince them, where sometimes it's 0% sort of share of wallet to make it 2% or something like that. And so I think it's a very complicated sale process. And it takes time. It's got a long lead cycle, if I were to describe it in corporate terms. And it's one that has to be very personalized and contextualized to the individual. So I think in those ways, it's so different. So you just have to unlearn the way you do it in the corporate world and figure out the context here is very, very different. And so therefore, how you influence government, you know, is very, very different here. So I think unlearning how you did in the corporate world and then learning a lot, I think the learning trajectory, and that's what excited me, as I told you. I think the principal reason to have a second career was just you're off on a new trajectory. And I think that's very much true. Whether you do your own thing or you transition as a corporate person full-time to working in a job in the social sector, or even if you do it part-time, I think one has to sort of think acutely about this, you know, what's different, and therefore tune oneself a little bit differently.
And back to one of the points you mentioned, Ashish, you know, metrics are much harder in this space, unlike in the corporate world where there's P&L and balance sheet. Given that, how do you set goalposts for your journey and for Central Square Foundation and for Ashoka?
Yeah, so I think if you look at, you know, Ashoka, I mean, obviously, eventually you'd look at, you know, where have your graduates gone and what have they done? I mean, if that's one of the things you're trying to change, right, is build leaders for different spheres. But that you're only going to find out in like 25 years. So it's too long a period. So I think in the near term, you use more of the standard indicators, which is on the student side, which is on the admission side, you know, how many people applied, what's the quality of those candidates measured in academic terms, you know, what's your percent selection rate, what percent decide to enroll if you make them an offer, what is your diversity and inclusion component look like, and how are we doing on that? So you can have a whole bunch of metrics around the whole outreach and admissions part, right? I mean, you can have a whole bunch of metrics around placement, where they're going, initial positions, salaries, you know, roles, you know, etc. You can have a bunch of metrics around faculty in terms of the recruitment and the caliber you're able to recruit and where they're coming from, which PhD programs, and how many people apply for an open position, what's the quality, you know, et cetera, et cetera. One can have a bunch of operational metrics in terms of the way you run the physical plant and stuff like that. On the teaching side, obviously, you know, every faculty member, every course is evaluated. So you have a teaching score, midterm and end of term, and you can aggregate that and look at teaching scores by department overall, see how you're progressing. So I think there are plenty of, on the research side, there's publications, citations, impact. So we are very metrics driven. And I think we are cognizant of what's sort of near term, what's medium term, and what's long term. If you want to build a great research and teaching university that really has leveraged impact. When I say leveraged impact, it is that many others then want to copy the model, that you're a pioneer for liberal arts education in India. It's not just the one institution you're building, but you're spreading an idea as well. And how can we measure whether we're successful on that spreading part as well, apart from the internal metrics of success? I think in CSF, we don't have as many of the levers of control, because Ashoka, we're of course subject to regulation and other things, but largely, you know, it's being built by the leadership team. So in CSF also, I think the ultimate is, you know, improvement in learning outcomes. And for that, you know, you look at many factors. So if we're looking at systems change, if we want UP's education system, and we're working in UP right now with the chief minister has announced a big program, is can you get the state committed, for instance, to basic numeracy and literacy, which is the main area we work on. And there the chief minister agreed finally to announce goals, what's called Prerna Lakshya in UP. So how do you initially get political commitment and, you know, get them to actually announce something that's a mission, put money behind it? I mean, those would be some metrics you'll measure in terms of the salience and the commitment at the political bureaucratic level. And we've got some metrics there. And then look at, you know, are you able to work with the state to bring about some curricular change, change their materials, move more towards structured pedagogy, You know, we've got some things we measure on that side. And then finally, from a delivery standpoint, you know, you can look at metrics around teachers who were trained differently. Are their actions changing in the classroom? You know, use an observation framework to see if the actions are changing or not. And then on the learning side, which is the outcomes, eventually you look at, there are lead indicators and there are final indicators. So let's take early literacy. Mm-hmm. The eventual metric you want is reading fluency and reading with comprehension. But the early indicator would be, you know, do kids recognize letters? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's shocking, but in India, you know, about 20% of children don't recognize letters even in second and third grade. So can we make that universal? Can you take it to 100%? Or decoding words is another building block leading up to reading with comprehension. So we have plenty of these, what I call, you've got a ladder of learning indicators as well, leading up to the final learning indicator. So apart from all the other system level indicators around governance, around some of the inputs and intermediary outcomes, there are these sort of, this ladder of learning outcomes that we look at.
Got it. Moving forward, Ashish, you have a unique insight into leadership, given your journey at Trust Capital, at Ashoka, Central Square Foundation, and so on. And you also have an insight into, you know, what's on young people's minds in terms of the people that come into Ashoka and graduate from Ashoka and so on. As we think about educating ourselves for the future, how do you think about how people should think about the choice, you know, STEM, liberal arts, something else? What's your, if a 18-year-old walked into your office and said, you know, how should I think about this choice? What are some of the themes in your head?
Yeah, so I have a bias here, but my general belief is that if we look at what the 21st century requires, I think it requires you to be a somewhat broad thinker, to be a critical thinker, firstly, to be able to analyze and think for yourself, think independently, to be a good communicator, both in written form and in oral form. It requires you to be able to connect the dots between different disciplines and different data points and to be able to deal with ambiguity. It requires you to be a lifelong learner. I mean, where most people are, a lot of people are in knowledge industries where things are changing every few years, and so you need to stay current, you need to be a lifelong learner. And we believe you need to have an understanding of the other or have a social conscience, right, to be successful. So my own sense is, I think STEM is extremely important. India needs, you know, lots of engineers. We did the right thing by, in a sense, prioritizing professional education. You know, as a poor country, you do need a certain crop of engineers and lawyers and accountants and, you know, a variety of management people, etc., professional people. But if you look at it, Deepak, I mean, even today with our engineers, of course, I think the Indian IT industry got built because of Tier 2 and Tier 3 engineering colleges, the better ones. And so that was critical. So I'm not suggesting for a moment we do away with that. All I'm saying is that in all aspects of education, whether you choose STEM or you choose to major in something else, that you should be well-rounded. So you should be exposed to other disciplines. So what I would ideally like is that the IITs, you know, the first year students learn how to write. They improve their writing. They get exposed to, you know, other disciplines early on, economics, philosophy, politics, and with the best faculty, you know, getting exposed to it. And not so much the 101 course, but the ways of thinking. Mm. So as opposed to the 101 economics where you're trying to, you know, just mug up the facts of microeconomics and macroeconomics. It's really, how does an economist think? How do ideas get developed in economics? What are the tools that an economist uses? So I think if you can get that broad exposure across different disciplines, it's these ways of thinking. I think that helps you later in life. As I told you, as an investor, I had to think like a psychologist. I had to think like a historian. I had to think like a macroeconomist. I had to think like a data analyst, you know, and be able to synthesize all that, right, to become a good investor is my belief. So I think that giving that broad education around ways of thinking is one. Two is, I think, making education more Socratic. So wherever it is, it's, I think, the flipped classroom, which is you read, you come to class, and class is more of a discussion versus a stage on stage. You know, some amount of lecturing is required, but I think given the online world and everything, frankly, somebody can record their lecture and you can watch it and come to class. So I think having more of a Socratic, I mean, why are you doing this physically? I think so that you can have more of a dialogue and push people's thing. And through that, people also learn, you know, you learn to think critically, you learn to build an argument as you express your own argument, you learn to listen to others and filter out noise and at the same time know which arguments to build upon, etc. So I think you're constantly sort of thinking and participating in the discussion, particularly if it's not too large a class. So I think I think the evaluation in Indian higher ed needs to move more towards more of a holistic evaluation. This idea of an exam and people sort of bunking class and then just studying for the exam is a fallacious one. I mean, you know, in life, that's not the way life works. So I think being assessed on classroom participation, on, you know, papers that you're writing every week, and eventually some exam which may have a smaller weight. So a more holistic evaluation. So I think what Indian higher ed needs to do is not a question of STEM versus liberal arts versus social. I think we need all, people need to study different disciplines. But my main premise is the system of higher ed needs to move one towards greater student choice so that student is in control. And when it's learner-centered, and when the learner feels he or she is in control, that's great. Two is they must have choice. So this idea of breadth and depth, and they can mix and match. They get exposed to certain foundations, but then they can mix and match. And obviously you need certain minimum depth in a particular discipline, right? But it doesn't have to be the same degree of depth that a narrow education offers you. A third is around the pedagogical approach, with more active learning, more of the Socratic method in the classroom. And the fourth is around the, you know, the assessment being more holistic and well-rounded. I think those are, and setting up, I think the residential setting like the IITs or IIMs, I think the reason they do better is versus a day college is that you a lot of your learning happens like through your peers at that age, you know, when you're 18 or 20. And so being able to construct it in a way where there's lots of 2 a.m. discussions in a hostel room or somewhere in a library, I think is absolutely critical for young minds to develop and future leaders to develop. So I think the residential context also is quite important, is my sense, if one were to build future leaders for the country.
Got it.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. When I look back at my 4 years at IIT Madras, actually, some of the courses I enjoyed the most were microeconomics, German, and Introduction to Modern Linguistics. All courses offered by the Humanities Department. They opened my eyes to a very different perspective and gave me an alternate lens to look at the world. Of course, I didn't quite use those lessons right away, but I do think they made a big difference to my mental models. I'd asked a similar question to Pramod Sinha, who Ashish speaks about earlier in the conversation, and he had an interesting take on the question.
I then start by saying, listen, I mean, it's good that it's okay that you don't know. There's nothing wrong with that, because otherwise people are under pressure that they are confused or they don't know.
They ought to know the answer, yeah.
They ought to know, and how come they don't know, and so on. So taking that pressure off and then helping them understand that, honestly, what you specialize in will not matter. In fact, this whole thing about, you know, specializing in a subject and then being in a career, and the line to that, as you know, is tenuous. It happens sometimes, but increasingly happens less and less. And so while it's important to major in something, it's not really that important to major in the right thing.
That's a good point.
And so that kind of releases the tension of a lot of parents and children when they realize, or sometimes they don't, but most of times you can actually show the parents themselves that what they major in and what they're doing now has no connection.
It puts the choice in perspective, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And so that then opens up a whole host of possibilities about what this kid could do. And I think that's when you move to the point of saying, okay, so what are your choices really?
Got it.
There are a host of choices. I mean, you could choose to go just study science or psychology or history or go abroad or stay in India. And it takes the pressure of having to get the decision right.
If we use the metaphor of an automobile, a lot of us grew up in a paradigm where there was an emphasis on building a strong engine. And this made sense in a contest where speed is a differentiating element, which works if you're in a career path with long roads and limited diversions. In a career that looks like a maze, the critical element in the automobile becomes the steering wheel. Back to what Pramath says, I guess we all need to start moving away from the focusing on the quality of the decision to the quality of the decision-making process. Do tune into my conversation with Pramath Sinha if this is of interest. You can go to playtopotential.com and click on the guest section. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Ashish Dhawan. No, couldn't agree more, having sort of benefited from those 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. discussions in IITM and IMA. Just a few questions as we wrap up, Ashish. I'm mindful of time. First is, you had a marker for 30 and marker for 45. As you think about your journey from here on, are there any macro markers which you have in mind, which would be your sort of guidepost as you think about choices?
Yeah, so I think one of the things I've been thinking about, Deepak, is how do I think in education, I'm still going to be very focused on it for the next, few years, till at least I'm 51 now, till at least 55. But do I have a sort of slightly wider portfolio of initiatives where I'm going beyond education? So that's, for me, is maybe the next move. I've already started seeding that in some ways. I set up a foundation to focus on air quality. I've got a couple of initiatives been seeded that are around talent development in the sector. I've got to set up a China-India Foundation that looks at learning from China, not looking at geopolitical issues, which are obviously very controversial. So I floated a few of these new things, really because I have multiple interests. And what I've learned from how I can drive impact in education, can I do it in a more leveraged way in a few other sectors, is something that's of interest to me. And beyond that, I don't know. I mean, could I write a book someday or do some of that? Possibly. I'm also very focused on having fun in life. I mean, you only have one life. It's not that I don't have fun right now. I do. I have a great time. But, you know, maybe at some point in life, just saying that I want to just chill a little bit and not always feeling like I need to be a producer, but also just enjoying being a pure consumer. So I joke with my wife that, you know, I'm going to buy a bar on the beach and that'll be my next life, you know. Serving drinks to people who are working really hard and need a break. But yeah, something different, you know. And so I don't know exactly what that is, but yeah,
got it.
And I do have many other interests in life that are unfulfilled. And around languages, around living in certain places. So who knows?
Got it. And why China, out of curiosity, of the various education models out there?
I'm sorry, I missed that, Deepak.
No problem. Why China? I heard you say learning from China.
Yeah.
Education. Yeah. There are multiple models out there, but I was curious how you picked China.
Yeah, so I've been going to China for the last 25 years, and I'm no China expert. I don't speak the language. I only knew a few words. But, you know, China is most proximate to India in that it's a very large country, similar population size. You know, through the colonial era, you know, went downhill effectively in terms of share of world GDP and really has woken up faster than India, at least on the economic front, and really, you know, powered through to becoming a middle-income country and squarely on its way to becoming a high-income country. So I think on the economic development side, I can't think of a better role model than China, because, you know, what happened in the US happened much earlier, and in Europe even earlier. And so it's not in living memory. You know, it's when you go talk to someone in the US or Europe about development, I mean, they look at their context and even what they've grown up with, and they can't relate to the Indian context. So I think what's interesting about China is not just the scale and the speed, but I think also the fact that it's happened in the last 20, 30 years. So it's in living memory. And you can actually go see, you can talk to people. And I think India, like if you look at like vocational education, would we be better off learning from China or learning from the US? I think from China, to be honest, because they've done it at scale and they've done it recently. And they've done it leveraging technology tools, which existed now and didn't exist, you know, 30 years ago. Or if you look at, you know, the way China has gone about developing a science and technology policy and how they pursued that, I think India can learn something from that. You know, the US did it after the Vannevar Bush plan in World War II. And of course, they've created a great military industrial scientific complex. But I think the Chinese one is staring us in the face, and it's been done more recently. Or even in development areas like public health. When we talk about, you know, Ayushman Bharat, 500 million people. The Chinese actually rolled out universal healthcare like over a decade ago. And so we can learn about how they empaneled hospitals and how they, you know, ensured that service delivery happened and how they quality assured it, you know, stuff like that. So I just think it's the scale, the speed, and the fact that it's proximate. It's just happened. It's important to unpack it and not miss out. It's also, I feel, because Indians don't go there that often and don't speak the language, that knowledge doesn't come to them as easily. I mean, there'll be a report here or there, but it's superficial. Whereas the knowledge from the West, you know, is coming to you in various packaged forms. And you often interact with people from there. You know, an Indian who works at IBM who tells you what's happening there. It doesn't happen. People will know more people at IBM than they will, you know, at Baidu, for instance. So, you know, I think in that sense, there's a role for an intermediary, in a sense, to unpack that knowledge and to get scholars to visit and not only do it itself, but create a leveraged ecosystem to make that happen, sort of catalyze that, that
movement. Interesting. Very interesting. And a couple of things before we wrap up, Ashish, as you've led your journey and continue marching on your mission, any leaders you look up to for inspiration? You spoke about Benjamin Franklin when you were a school student, but given your current stage of life, who are the people that inspire you?
Yeah, so I'm clearly very inspired by some of our corporate leaders. I think Mr. Premji is a real role model in terms of the way he conducts himself, his approach to, you know, his wealth and the trusteeship around his wealth and, you know, everything he's built. I mean, I really look up to him. I mean, there are, of course, many others. Nandan, I think, for his dynamism, I think, and just cutting edge, I think, approach to the development sector or India's social problems in terms of technology, societal platforms, and both on the commercial side even, I think, looking at how you can build these public goods, whether it's Aadhaar or the payments platform and other platforms. So, you know, I think folks like that are in India, I find to be very inspiring. And they're clearly my role models.
Got it. And especially for people who are at a crossroad or in transition, Ashish, I know you're a voracious reader, but are there one or two books that come top of mind for you people, for people who are sort of trying to figure out what's the next mountain for me to climb?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, these books tend to be a little bit sector specific, but if one just wants to read something a little bit inspirational, I think John Woods, the guy who started Room to Read, was at Microsoft and transitioned. to setting up his own NGO. So I would read his two books because I think they're just, you know, he came with the corporate context, got inspired, made the switch. And so even though it's a more of a human interest story, less technical, I think for folks who are haven't thought about it as much, I think that's a great place to start, is my own sense. And then if you want to understand things like, you know, systems change, you know, I would say, you know, as opposed to reading books, I would just read some of the articles and blogs written by, you know, people at the Kennedy School and other places like that, the Oxford Blavatnik School. There are people who are these system thinkers like Matt Andrews and Land Pritchard and, you know, a bunch of others, Michael Barber. So I would read those kinds of folks on more of the system change side.
Got it. And just wrapping up, Ashish, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. Given your journey, given the various hats you wear, and given your view of the world, what are your headline thoughts on people playing to their unique potential?
Yeah, so I think that if each person will figure out their own trajectory. My only sense is that all of us have a social conscience, and whilst we may do whatever and, you know, make as much money as we want, and even through the corporate world, I think there's a great opportunity for social impact. So I believe that business is a force for good, if well done. So one is, I think, through business itself, one can have great societal impact. But one has to be honest about it and not just drink the Kool-Aid or justify it to oneself. You can't run a cigarette company and believe that, right? So, and even if you're, I mean, the thing with impact investing also is people can just put the label on. So one is, I think, through the business world, how can that be a force for good and unleash entrepreneurial energy to solve some of India's biggest problems? And then I would urge people to at least dabble in the social sector, to read a little bit, maybe even find one organization, or even just read what the Tata Trusts are doing and Azim Premji Foundation is doing, Gates Foundation, read Bill Gates's annual letter, read MSDF and Umidyar. And, you know, I think it'd be interesting for corporate people to just see that it's quite sophisticated what happens in the social sector, how complex it is. And I think it'll just enhance their worldview and may lure them to, even if not make the transition full-time, which I hope some people will, even consider, you know, getting onto an NGO board or a foundation's board or serving as an advisor part-time. I think having a little bit of that element added to your life will lead to a richer life, create greater purpose in one's life, but also a great learning experience and get you to think about things very differently. And for those who really want to jump in headlong, you know, I funded a wonderful woman, Anu Prasad, who's created a program called ILSS, Indian Leaders for the Social Sector, which really does a 9-day boot camp for corporate leaders who want to consider transitioning, and then literally works with them for 6 to 12 months to see if we can find the right home for them, whether it's part-time or full-time. So if people are serious about that, they should go to the ILSS website.
Very interesting. Ashish, it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thank you, Deepak. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Likewise. Thank you.
I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of things before we wrap up. As you would appreciate, quite a bit of effort goes in identifying speakers, reaching out to them, having the conversation, editing it, slicing it into nuggets, cross-referencing it to other pieces and so on. And we bring this content free of charge to you. The only humble request is that if you're deriving value and if this podcast has made a difference to your life, consider making a difference to another life. I would urge you to consider contributing to Antarang Foundation, a not-for-profit that I support. You can visit playtopotential.com and see the paid forward section for more details. In case you want to consider getting your feet wet in the social impact world, consider becoming a part of Social Venture Partners. It's a group of philanthropists who come together and offer a little bit of money and time to the social impact organizations. It's a combination of a VC firm and a consulting firm where you figure out where you want to deploy the corpus that you collect, and then you assemble teams to work with the organizations. In fact, that's how I got introduced to Antarang Foundation, and it's been a very fulfilling journey with Social Venture Partners over the 4+ years. Do let me know if you need any more details or if you want me to connect you to somebody in this space. Finally, do take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume this content. It might seem like a small thing for you, but it makes a big difference. Over the last few months, the podcast supply has exploded, and your review or your rating helps the listeners figure out the signal from the noise as they choose which podcast they want to listen to. It also gives a reassurance to potential guests that this is worth their time. So if you can, please do take a moment to do this. Thank you for listening, and bye now.